Mud Podcast presents.
Welcome to Fire Radio. For the Southern Humboldt Fire Safe Council, I'm Gray Shaw. We have a packed evening tonight for you. Lots of information and lots of guests, all of whom wear different hats. Tonight, they're from fire departments Telegraph Ridge and Briceland and other programs as well. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the programs related to fire prevention and control and where those programs are leading us towards prescribed burning. So, Tanner, why don't you start us off? We'll be talking about your work with Humboldt County Public Works Natural Resources Planning and the Trees Foundation.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Shaw. Thanks for having me today, and thanks to Southern Humboldt Fire Safe Council. And I'm glad that we could be here. Looks like we're having a – how's that?
That number is – oh, it's number four.
Hold on there if you can hear me. Hey, is that a little better?
Can we hear him now? Here, use my mic.
Can you hear me now?
Maybe go ahead and use that one next to you. Right. Sorry about that.
Okay.
How's that? Can you hear me a little better? All right. Thank you. Okay. Well, we'll move on. Yes, my name is Tanner Spees. I work with Humboldt County Public Works Natural Resources Planning. I actually wear many hats in the conversation we're going to have tonight, both with the fire department. I'm the fire chief of Telegraph Ridge. I also work with Trees Foundation. All of these organizations are working on three specific defensible space projects that we're going to be talking about. And it kind of tells a little bit of a story that we're hoping to share, because this is a pretty positive and ambitious and true story that's happening right now. So the first, it kind of starts out with these wildfire prevention grants that have been funding defensible space, roadside clearing, and chipper days in our area for some years now, and one in specific called the Community Wildfire Protection Phase 5 Wildfire Preparedness Grant. And we brought in Damien Rumetz here also, who is the executive director of the Trees Foundation, because Natural Resources Planning contracted with Trees Foundation to be the coordinator of this grant. And so we've been working really closely. And this has gone very well at this point. We're kind of finishing up the deliverables, the objectives of this grant, and right now are really happy to kind of report on some of those, because they wound up very successful. And when we started them out, they were challenging. We knew, like, the idea of doing a chipper day in our vast rural areas around here, we knew there was going to be some challenges behind that, and there were. But overall, you know, for what we set out to do, we beat all the objectives that we were looking at. Also with this, there was some capacity building, some great lessons learned that all led to these other defensible space projects that we're going to be talking about tonight. But maybe with that, I'll pass it to you, Damien, and you could talk a little more.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Tanner. And I also appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight, Gray and K-Mud. So this you would have thought about as the Chipper Days program, or when we were going around town and starting to get a little bit of defensible space work done. Yeah, there was a lot of people to thank on that. I'd like to thank Chelsea Sproul from Trees, who did a great job coordinating it for us, and also for the Humboldt County Public Works and Natural Resource Planning with Sibel Emmett and Julia Cavalli and Tanner, obviously, helping really bring that to the community. And we were just kind of brought in to help coordinate half of the Phase 5 program along with Shelter Cove. So this was the same Chipper Days program that was happening simultaneously out at the Cove. You kind of had to put the piles out there, and then we'd come around. Jonathan Lehman and Lost Coast Tree came out and did a lot of the implementation on this, and we were able to put together 32 Chipper Days, which was 8 more than our initial objective. We serviced over 170 properties, chipped 1,096 piles for approximately 6,696 cubic yards of material that's not going to burn for us. We did 25 home risk assessments to help educate people about home hardening, which was 5 more than we were intending. Initially, we got 25 defensible space treatments done. Similarly, five more than we had initially planned, which was great. We got to come to people's houses and at no cost to them take care of a lot of the hazardous fuels around their home and within their primary zone zero, zone one, and zone two. I don't know if we're all starting to feel familiar with that lingo, but just getting the closest fuels away from the house as a primary and then moving out and trying to keep the fire activity reasonable if there ever were a fire in the area, and then the firefighters can get in there and engage. We also had, like Tanner had kind of mentioned, this program that we're talking about now that is ending is kind of the beginning of the next two programs that are happening, and we're really working with the grant funding that we're receiving in the area to try to build the capacity for Southern Humboldt, Northern Mendocino, our region down here to effectively manage our forests and reduce our wildfire risk, along with a bunch of other benefits.
Yeah, and so with that, the next step of that was part of the capacity building of the Phase 5 program was with coordination from Trees Foundation and a very generous match donation by the University Cooperative Extension and Jana Valakovic, who is the forest advisor there. We worked together to put on a home risk assessment technician training. That was in Bryceland, very generous also of Bryceland Volunteer Fire Department to host that. We had I think 16 members who went through that training. And out of those, we basically were able to fill the technician roles both in the Bryceland, the Southern Humboldt Defensible Space Project, and the Shelter Cove Wildfire Resiliency and Community Defense Grant. So this is kind of an example of how the Phase 5 project was able to build on the home risk assessment process that was originally developed in those earlier stages by Sibel Emmett and Julia Cavalli, and then was able to move into this other realm where now we're using defensible space management software and have technicians who are out doing this work. Which also to note, at this point, the technicians are all also volunteer firefighters in our area. So they do have both the kind of invested knowledge and feeling of service to the community, which we think stacks some pretty good functions there. So
that's like a two-pronged approach. You've got the defensible space work, and you've got people also being trained to do home hardening evaluations.
Yeah. The home risk assessment goes through both. It's got these two elements. The one side that does kind of teach people about what they can do personally to mitigate the fire hazard on their house. And a lot of the times those can be small little things that people might not know, like fixing, you know, replacing the vent coverings, you know, to a smaller gauge so that embers can't get through the vents under their house. You know, things like that can be relatively simple. And it's an educational process. And then also at the same time, the home risk assessment technicians are also starting the vegetation, hazardous vegetation removal or treatment plan.
Great. Well, that's great. The next thing I think we want to get to on the list is the Bryceland Volunteer Fire Department and the Natural Resource Planning at Edersburg Fire Safe Council. And Ligel, I think you're the one who's going to talk about that.
Yep. Hi. Good evening, everybody. So, yeah, my name is Ligel Dillon. I'm the project manager. I work for Bryceland Volunteer Fire Department as the project manager for this SOHUM Defensible Space Project. Yeah, so far it's been going really good, you know. We got off to kind of a late start in the season, and, you know, it's been really good. So far, we're coming to the end of this program, the end of November, and so we're really trying to make a big push here to, you know, really get to our minimum goal of 90. The goal starting out was to accomplish 90 to 100 defensible space treatments. So far, we've got 68 home risk assessments completed and 63 defensible space treatments completed. So we've got a little ways to go, and we're going to really make a big push and do everything we can to to meet our goals by the end of the deadline. And yeah, so far it's been really good. We've had a really good response from the community. I feel like we're, you know, like Tanner said, it's providing sort of, you know, a lot of benefits to the community as far as fire safety, but it also provides some, you know, really needed jobs right now for some of our volunteer firefighters. Yeah, so it's really great. You know, there's kind of two aspects. I'll just touch on it real quick. Like Tanner said, there's when the home risk assessment is done, there's two sort of aspects to that. One is the home hardening aspect. So the technician will look at things that the homeowner can do for the actual structural part of the house. Things like, you know, the vent screening. One of the most common things around here is that space between the bottom of your wall and the ground. A lot of homes around here are built on post and pier foundations. So, you know, things like that, you can cover that up with a non-combustible material, metal, fiber cement board, you know, brick, something like that. So that's crucial. You know, for people to really get a complete idea of the whole thing, they can go to the website, right? That's humboldt.gov.org/firesafecouncil. And if you go to that, you can scroll down and you'll see the Home Defensible Space project, and you can click on that. There's a link right there to the interest form. You can sign up right there, and once you're in the system, I'll reach out and get it going and get the home risk assessment scheduled and go from there. There's a prioritization process that happens with this project. In order to receive the free service, you do need to qualify for one of the eligibility criteria: low income, senior, or disabled. Or you could qualify for, you know, one, two, or three of those criteria. Obviously, the more criteria you meet, the higher priority you'll be put on the list. So, you know, that's one of the things really that's important to us, is reaching out and finding the people in the community that really could use the service the best, you know. So if you have friends and neighbors out there that, you know, you think really could use the service, or you yourself qualify, you know, for those criteria, definitely check out the website, you know, fill out the interest form and get in there. And, you know, we're trying our best to get to as many people, obviously, as we can with this project. And I think we're all pretty hopeful that something like this will happen again in the future. So I'd say, you know, if we don't get to you this round, maybe there'll be another round. You know, maybe that's being optimistic, but I think we all have to be optimistic in this day and age. So,
well, yeah. One successful project begets another. So I think we can look forward to that. So
absolutely.
Kudos to all of you for getting that important work done.
Yeah.
The next thing on the list that we wanted to talk about is the Shelter Cove Improvement District and Fire Department has a wildfire resiliency and community defense project of its own. And for that, we're going to hear from Michael Carter.
Hi, I'm Michael Carter with Telegraph Ridge. I'm the training officer and happy to be part of this. And speaking of that, building on what the successes have been, the Shelter Cove project has been just a boon for the community. It's bringing optimism to everybody, and what makes it a little more unique is everybody qualifies for it. There's still some residents that will ask me, how much is this going to cost me? Is this going to come out of my, I'm going to get a big tax bill? But it's actually everybody has getting it. It's been funded through the Farm Bill. So everybody, we just need more people to sign up, and we've built on the success of these other projects. We've got over 200 home risk assessments completed, and we're getting ready to start doing the contracting for getting the work done. And it's just been great to be out there with the community, where they're finding a way to take their power back of, you know, of the what we have lost from different tragedies in other rural areas, what affects one of us affects all of us. So we all kind of live with that. And this has been a great thing to see the smiles on their face thinking, oh, you know, we can actually do something to enable a brighter, safer future.
Yeah, and so this grant too, just to kind of give a little background on it, this was written by the Shelter Cove Fire Department, particularly Chief Pape out there, and the RID. They're the ones who came up with this. This was a massive service to our area in general. They went super ambitious with this grant and got it because of the strength of their proposal, and it's bringing massive amounts of money both in contracting to our area, and it's going to address, as Michael was saying, every single house out of the cove. We're looking to do 540 plus houses out there. There's going to be approximately 820 acres of private undeveloped parcels that are going to be treated, another 240 acres of RID new treatments and retreatments. So that's like Greenbelt area and shaded fuel break that was already put in. It was a visionary grant. So we definitely want to, give the thanks and appreciation to Shelter Cove Fire Department, Chief Pape, and the RID. With that, they put a contract out for the coordination of this project, and Damien and myself put in a proposal for that, and were awarded that contract. So Trees Foundation is coordinating that, and we're really thankful again to have that opportunity. Mike here is one of the home risk assessments on our team out there. All of the home risk assessments that we have are also volunteer firefighters with multiple different fire departments, including Shelter Cove, Whitethorn, and Telegraph Ridge. So yeah, it's another great project, and you can just see how this progress is building. We're sharing the same home risk assessment software that the Bryceland project, the Southern Humboldt Defensible Space Project, is using, as well as a project that's happening in Willow Creek with the Willow Creek Fire Safe Council too. And that's all being held under this kind of coordinated partnership with the Humboldt County Resource Conservation District and the Humboldt County Fire Safe Council County Coordination Team. So there's all these things coming together. It's a really great example of our community, our county coming together and working together to get work done for people and do some workforce development.
Well, if it sounds like a blizzard of names and programs and objectives, I can sympathize. I just wanted to emphasize that the money's out there. We've heard for a long time that there's lots of money just floating around out there for this type of project, but it takes programs like this being written and developed and coordinated for the money to actually deliver the services that we're talking about tonight.
Yes, exactly.
One of the things I think is really great to think about too, Gray, is just how many, we're hearing some similar names in some different places, but then there's all the other organizations that have a role in making this all happen. And one of the ones at the center of that is the Southern Humboldt Fire Safe Council that created the project concepts that eventually became part of other larger programs. And so there's like obviously a pretty active community of fire interested folks in Southern Humboldt. But we are finding through these grants and through collaboration that we're able to continually scale up what we're capable of doing. And I think that's really exciting to me and to people that are at this table and all the other, Bryceland, the Trees Foundation, just that we might be able to create a little bit of an economy here based on taking care of the forests and reducing our wildfire threat and kind of bringing that team attitude back to our community. So I'm really excited. And we have a bunch of other things happening coming up right in the next could be this week, but lots happening. And it's just a really, for me, exciting time to be seeing the developments in Southern Humboldt. So.
Well, yeah, speaking of which, like, these are just a few of the projects, right, and a few of the partners, because this is all building on these other projects that were happening, say, in Salmon Creek. Like you mentioned, there was fuel side reduction. I know they just got awarded another grant through the Humboldt County Resource Conservation District Partnership, I believe, which is going to be a massive amount of ingress and egress clearing that is very likely to produce more jobs as well. Beautiful accomplishment there. I know the Mattole Restoration Council, as we all know, has been doing great work for so many years and has been involved with this too, partnering with the County Public Works on many grants as well, and also leading their own. So yeah, I think we are really seeing this kind of success building, and it's at a pretty important time in our area because, as we do know, yeah, it's been going through we've been going through some economic challenges, and yeah, people, I think, both need workforce opportunities as well as kind of some hope and vision for you know, what our life looks like around here. What the culture, which way we're going. And I think if we can go in the direction of fire safety and forest health, you know, those are both really positive things for our area.
Yeah, wildfire is an equal opportunity destroyer. And we have an opportunity here to act equally compatibly with each other to come up with solutions. And so it's wonderful to hear all these programs and how they're coordinated with each other. I think that's the thing to take home from this, is that we have a real team here. And these are two different fire departments and actually several more that are tied in together to take on this challenge of excess fuel. And if it seems overwhelming, it certainly is, but we're making progress on it. And that's the emphasis.
Yes, and we do need to give credit up where it's due to with the funding sources, right? The Phase 5 was a CAL FIRE wildfire defense grant. The Southern Humboldt Defensible Space project is actually California Fire Safe Council grant in coordination with CAL FIRE as well. And the Shelter Cove Wildfire Resiliency and Community Defense Grant is a USDA wildfire prevention grant.
Yeah, I just want to give a shout out to the crew. You know, these guys are doing a really good job, guys and gals out there doing this work. You know, they're volunteer firefighters, they're first responders. You know, they're out there, they're covering CAL FIRE stations when CAL FIRE is out of area. You know, they're waking up in the middle of the night to respond to emergencies, and then they're getting up to go to work and do defensible space work. So, you know, I just really want to give a shout out to everybody on the crews out there doing all this work, because, you know, it is it's demanding, you know, and so they deserve some credit.
So where's all this going? You know, we're going to be taking charge of the fire, of the wildfire situation for some time by getting on top of fuels and hardening homes. I think the future is important to talk about too, and we wanted to spend some time talking about that. And the future is to put good fire, healthy fire, on the ground. Why don't we start talking about that now?
Yeah. And I think, you know, to start that conversation, I think it's really good to kind of go back to an assumption that people had for a long time that led us to this place. And that was the idea that fire exclusion was possible and was a good solution. And it has come around at this point to where we see, especially those who have fought it for so many years and seen the fuels just stack. And the actual fuel in the forest, you put the fires out, and eventually you start to say, what is the end game here, right? And I think the mixture of fire prevention, the fire and emergency response world, also with the realm of environmentalism and kind of forestry management, and then definitely built on traditional ecological knowledge and cultural knowledge, came together to assert that no, fire exclusion is not an option.
So this is something we actually can take a page of from the Native Americans, who've been using fire on the ground for millennia.
Well, because the problem that we're having right now can largely be traced back to, you know, the period of complete fire exclusion that was largely implemented by more modern Western culture.
So-called civilization. Yeah.
And then the lessons come around, and hopefully we're learning. And in that, you know, the idea of management through fire, and as you put it, good fire, that fire is not just something that's bad that we must always stop. You know, out of control wildfire in August with 90 degree wind, you know, temperatures and 30 mile an hour winds, definitely. Yeah. But other times of the year, that it can be a super useful tool.
Yeah. So it's something that you can do to take advantage of by, if you're eligible, you can get defensible space fuel treatments around your house, and you can get home assessments so that your building will withstand an ember wash. But what are some of the other ways that people can become involved to volunteer?
Well, so with the prescribed fire world, I would definitely point the direction to the Humboldt County Prescribed Burn Association. And we do have a Southern Humboldt Prescribed Burn Association chapter as well. So you can go online and check that out. They have a very reasonable membership. I believe it's $25 a year. And if you're a firefighter, I believe you get a free membership. I definitely suggest anyone out there listening and interested to join up just to support the cause and also to get involved or to just learn more about it. It's a great resource to learn. I know that Henry Holbrook, who is one of the primary contacts in the Humboldt County Prescribed Burn Association, is a great person to get more information from. Our Southern Chapter president is Kai Ostro, who I bet many of the listeners know, who grew up in this area, and also the great resource to learn about. One of the things I like to put the word out for is that if you're interested, also too, the Prescribed Burn Association is a great way to get involved by actually, you know, you can show up and actually get a little bit of training and get a little bit of guidance, and you can be involved with putting fire on the ground.
So, yeah, the first time I went out on a prescribed burn, they put a torch in my hand.
Yeah.
You know, so that's likely to happen for you. If you wanted to volunteer, you wouldn't have to just sit on the sidelines and watch. You could see, feel what it's like to work with fire, to put good fire on the ground and see what it does.
Yeah, and I hope, I think what we're going to see too as the years go on, we're going to see more and more of the long-term positive effects of this. I know it can be scary right now. I know the idea that we're going from a scary, potentially catastrophic wildfire era, you know, summer, like a season, and then suddenly shifting over into a prescribed burn season can seem scary and maybe ill-advised. But we kind of wanted to talk tonight a little bit about why that's necessary and how those differences are so dramatic on fire effects. And how if we waited till it was completely over into the winter and wet and raining, that the fire wouldn't actually even be able to accomplish the work that it was we were trying to get it to accomplish. So there's this sweet spot in there that we call a burn window.
Yeah, so between the burn season. Yeah, so between the burn season and winter.
Yeah. Well, where it's dry enough that fuel will burn, but you have kind of these guardrails on it with weather conditions. And ultimately, you know, it's what's not going to be an emergency, you know, situation. We're looking for and this is built into the burn plan through the prescription. And that's why they call it prescribed fire, is there is a prescription.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
If you're just joining us, this is the Fire Radio program with the Southern Humboldt Fire Safe Council. And my guests tonight are Tanner Spies, the chief of the Telegraph Ridge Volunteer Fire Department, who was just speaking, Michael Carter, also of that department, both of whom are also on the Trees Foundation. Damian Rumitz, yet another member of the Trees Foundation and member of Bryson Volunteer Fire Department. And Ligel Dillon, who is the project manager for the Bryson Volunteer Fire Department Defensible Space Project, we were talking about earlier. So again, thank you all for joining us. Well, what's left to discuss, guys? You want to pick up on maybe any of these topics?
Yeah, maybe I could expand on what Tanner was saying. And I think it's relevant because we are, you know, we had a fire last night out in the Woods Ranch area. And that was, for a lot of us, kind of scary. And then maybe in a week from now, we might be burning and saying we're putting good fire on the ground. And I think it's really important for people to understand how that could be, you know, such a confident assertion that we make when we do start burning with the intention of doing good work as opposed to just being arsonists. So the actual way that fuels react and fire behaves when it is on, you know, when there is a fire, is largely determined by some factors like the weather and the fuel moistures and some really kind of in-depth scientific research that we start to geek out on a little bit sometimes at the fire department. But it could be the difference between, like, you all know when you come out first thing in the morning and something sparks that you're not that worried if there's dew on the grass or if there's there'd been a good, we call, recovery at night where there was a lot of moisture in the air and the fuels kind of, especially the light flashy fuels, kind of rehydrated a little bit. And so, like, even throughout the course of every day, that the burning conditions will change, and so you're kind of waiting for these certain special fuel moistures and wind speeds and aspects with the sun, and you kind of bring this all together to, at this point, we're starting to get a decent idea, I knock on wood, and I'm not a burn boss, but just, you know, how to use fire as a tool and effectively. And if you wait till 2 in the afternoon when fire behavior really starts to pick up, then that's usually not going to be what the prescription is calling for. And it's just kind of, it's like Tanner was saying earlier, going out and experiencing good fire is a completely different emotional experience than what it's like to experience it when it's a wildfire. So we have a caller. We're going to go to them, but maybe we can talk more about all these things as we go with the show tonight.
Caller, you're on the air.
You know, what I am curious about, and I want to remind people, please contribute not only to your volunteer fire departments, but this station, because they're an essential part of the emergency safety net that we have out here. What I'd like to find out is, on these prescriptive burn programs that you guys have, what is the post-burn operation? For instance, what do you plant in the area to help the land, the waterways, the wildlife, and the, along with the flora, recover? And do you gravel in certain areas and not in others? Things like that. And if there, like, what is the Trees Foundation stance on presenting information to people, and how might that be done? I think all this is important, and I really appreciate all you guys do, and also the inmates and prisoners that work alongside you guys a lot of times. Be interesting to find out some of the inside scoop on how you guys deal with each other in that capacity, because you're all out there to fight the fire at that point. And it's a very fascinating safety net. I think all of you should get paid, the prisoners, inmates, the volunteers, when you're out there in the field. And I understand sometimes when there's hazardous duty, so to speak, there is some income that you guys get, but you certainly deserve it. You probably deserve a hell of a lot more. And I'll leave it at that and listen to your response, or maybe that's fuel for future shows. You guys have a good night. Thanks.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. I think I agree with that. And when we're talking about fire, we're talking, and particularly when we're talking about the future of fire's role on the landscape, we're talking about ecology. And so the points that you made are perfectly correct, that we need to be concerned about vegetation that takes the place of whatever burns. The issue we're having now is that we're in uncharted territory because we've had fire suppression for so long that we really don't have a model to base our work on, and we're just going to have to figure it out. But those are issues that you described that need to be taken under consideration.
Yeah, and too, I'd just like to say that we do our best in these projects to include field monitoring and ecological monitoring both during and after. We are looking to try to gather as much information and metrics as possible to make sure that it is actually good fire. That is a strong intention that I have seen with everybody I've been involved with Prescribed Fire. And one other thing, too, I just wanted to clarify on the radio here is that most of the projects that we're involved with here are truly coming from the ground up. This is a ground up movement. We basically start at a landowner level. Usually it's a landowner who does see kind of this vision and wants to utilize this aspect of land management. So at this point, the projects that are happening are largely small, decentralized projects. These aren't large, top-down plans projects at this point. These are coming from people who are interested and joining the PBA and then oftentimes reaching out to other agencies. The fire departments oftentimes get involved to make sure that, that they don't turn into emergencies. But I'll pass to...
Yeah, I'll try to answer one of your questions, caller. The prescribed burns are done from a point of regeneration. We've seen a lot of fir encroachment in our oak woodlands. Some, like Tanner was saying, the particular landowner has a grassland that he wants to reestablish that's been taken over by invasive species. And so we're looking at it from a place of regenerating natural balance, and what that's our goal with how we're using the fire.
And expanding on that, Michael, what we find often is that fire gives native plants a competitive advantage for, like Gray was saying, millennia. The native people have been putting fire on the ground. And even as recently as 100 years ago, it was common practice this time of year, maybe within the next month or so, to see ranchers out there burning the land. And over this time, the plants that have been established here and are our native plants have developed alongside that and have learned to actually use that as an advantage. It can kill bugs. It can do things that that feed the nutrients into the soil that benefit the types of plants that have been here for millennia as well. And so do you need to do something afterwards? Sometimes you might want to encourage certain species to take hold in an area where you might see them already naturally trying to thrive or establish something new, but you might not need to at all. In fact, we had a burn out at the Kimtu side of the community park this summer that was an emergency situation. But since then, we've gone back and we've seen a lot of native species coming back stronger than ever before, and some of the invasive grasses still kind of reeling from it. So it's possible that there's not exactly as much work. Like part of this, if we do this correctly, is going to reduce the total workload in the process that we're – this daunting process that we see in front of us and get us back to, like Michael was saying, a level of regenerative balance and restoration. And then to answer another couple questions, caller, I would like to just personally say, obviously, people that wind up on inmate crews might have made or found themselves in a difficult situation. Many of these folks are there for nonviolent offenses and likely have gone through some level of rehabilitation that allows them to be on these crews when they are. And as volunteer firefighters, we have tremendous respect for their work ethic when they're out there. They really do an outstanding job. And we appreciate them. There's certain rules that we, have to abide by. And obviously, I don't want to hold up anything, dealing with the fact that they're in prison up at a pedestal. But those guys, a lot of them are coming out and finding careers in the fire service as well. And that's another version of a success story that we think is really amazing. So, yeah, there's always, when you're out on fire, it's all good people.
Yeah, it's an example of real rehabilitation. And something we probably should point out is that the Native Americans had a multitude of reasons for putting fire on the ground. So as we begin to shift from simply reducing the fuel to noticing what plants are coming up, and in permaculture, the first rule is to observe, you'll see things and you'll learn what the land wants, what it's doing, what it's trying to do. And the first burn is just the beginning of a transition towards back into the direction of a ecosystem that is adapted to fire as it used to be. So this is a sort of a portal for all of us in our culture to learn about the land in a way that we've really not been attuned to.
Yeah, it's definitely important to remember, you know, fire is a tool and it's a powerful one. And I think when it comes to prescribed burning, it can be used in a lot of different ways, right? It can be used to manage, you know, the ladder fuels in the understory. It can also be used to control invasive species in grasslands, right? I can't remember the name of the grass that
Medusa head is one,
right,
of them.
The Medusa head was the target species on the grassland burn on Perry Meadow a couple falls ago, I guess now. But yeah, so I mean, it's, you know, it's a tool that can be used, you know, for a lot of different aspects of managing, you know, the land, not just forest land, but, and not just grassland, but both, or, you know, a mix of all things. So it's really like very specific to the prescription and the, you know, the purpose, the goal. When you set out with, you know, to do a prescribed burn, you're really, you know, you have a goal, you have a target, and there are metrics later on to go and evaluate those things.
Now, what the burn boss is supposed to do is to write down the objectives, and it can include and should include landscape plants as well. So Medusa head happens to be an invasive exotic that was brought in accidentally and became a problem for ranchers, and it actually can be addressed with fire better than with any other means.
Yeah, and so, yeah, referring to, so there are the prescribed burn plans, right? That's the actual document that is built to kind of back up the thinking behind the project. And that's I've been learning about that through a local group that Kai Ostro kind of founded called the Burn Plan Cadre. We call it, it's a group of us who he's been helping us learn how to do this, how to build these burn plans. And actually some of the projects that are coming up are some of the fruits of that project. And it's really interesting to learn about what goes into that. And as Elijah was noting, one of the important parts is the objectives, right? You want to start with clear objectives. So you're not just putting fire on the ground for no reason. You know, what are you trying to do? In our area, yeah, oftentimes it is hazardous fuel reduction. It's oftentimes fir encroachment abatement. Oftentimes it's oak woodland restoration or grassland restoration. Those are really common ones in our area. As we've been seeing fir encroachment creating a little bit of more of a monoculture of large swaths of our land around here. But then, yeah, and then you get into the actual calculations of what kind of fire are going to achieve those objectives. I loved you bringing up the permaculture observation. Do you remember? I was taught the acronym PATO, prolonged and thoughtful observation, right? Which is a great one to think about, you know. And I totally second what you're saying. Is that's what we're here to do. Oftentimes, the objectives that we're looking to reach, we know are not going to be reached through a single pass of fire. Like oftentimes we're talking about potentially two or three to get it to a management regime. And then after that, it should be it's going to be a whole different ball game. Right now we're trying to, you know, eventually the actual reduction of hazardous fuels should become a lot less of one of our common objectives.
Great. We have another caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I was recently at a talk that was put on by the dean at the Library of Cal Poly Humboldt, and they have a lot of new digital resources, and I wanted to let you know that they have a Sims table, which is a situation incident management system table that you can use, and it's open to the public and organizations. You can go in there and input your variables, so you can have weather conditions and response times, look at your engine resources, et cetera, available. And you can do different scenarios. And so I really encourage different fire safe councils to look at that and utilize it. It's a great resource that we have regionally. So I'll just put that out there. Thanks. I'll get off the air.
Yeah, thank you for that. Thanks for the input there. And we are at a time, I believe, where a lot of these resources are, you know, we're about to enter kind of a new era of resources like this. I know right now we're using fuel modeling that is fairly, let's say, aged.
Dated.
Dated, yeah.
Comes on a floppy disk.
It comes on a floppy disk, but it's still, it's very useful. But I do believe we're potentially going to enter a new era here. I'm looking forward to what we're going to be seeing. But the fuel modeling is interesting too. We do, like with the burn plans, there is fuel modeling built into that to basically double check the numbers that we're looking at. So oftentimes you do kind of work backwards, because oftentimes the burn boss has, through their experience, a lot of intuitive and experiential knowledge of what they're expecting and what they would like to see. And then you oftentimes use the modeling just to kind of back those numbers up in with metrics.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say it's a contract between the burn boss and the landowner in terms of the objectives.
And Bill, you know, you guys were mentioning some objectives, and I just wanted to bring up, you mentioned, Gray, the cultural burning and the multitude of objectives there. But I just, with the Pato and then the concept, like we're also kind of with our maybe learning from our mistake of suppression over the years, like maybe a little bit of humbleness to look around and try to learn, be a little bit more open-minded than we were before. And I just feel really grateful to have been able to, with Trees Foundation, work with some of the local Wailaki community and some of the nonprofit organizations that are getting started here to help also reestablish cultural burning in our area. And what I really think is interesting and kind of turns all this on a different angle here is that when I talk to some of my my partners that are doing the cultural burning with us, say Perry Lincoln from Native Health and Native Hands, he talks about, you know, part of what we're doing here too is making the forest healthy so that we can provide food for all the animals that used to be here that still haven't been able to come back. And you'll notice after a burn that the animals will come and they'll want to see what happened and they'll be excited to come back and graze on the fresh green grass. And a lot of like the capacity building that we throw around here in the community as far as the fire communities, I've really it's fun to have the perspective continue to expand, thinking about all the other communities that are benefiting from this work and how we're building capacity in communities and trying to bring animals back. You know, we've been long interested in getting fish back in the rivers, but also, you know, we used to have a bunch. I mean, for those folks that I talk to that have been here for a long time, you know, they'll talk about the various critters that just aren't around much anymore. But we're starting to see California condors back up on the Klamath River, coming down here and looking for places to set up shop. And we could be restoring, you know, all kinds of things, even just as objectives with this burning. It's pretty exciting.
An example of that, I think, is some of the work that Sanctuary Forest has done over the years, showing the correlation between the large amounts of Douglas fir in our forests and that potential correlation to the water usage and the lack of water in our rivers, which is, you know, part of what we're trying to address. So there, I think there is some there's some evidence that we could be looking at this application as actually helping put more water in the river.
For sure.
Yeah. So it's an interesting way to look at that, yeah. Right? That fire could create more water in the river.
I look at it as fish need fire, and everything that we do in forestry ought to be helping the fish. And that's actually another reason why it's a totem species. It establishes that what we're doing is correct if they come back. And when we talk about the effect of fire on the forest, it's the number of stems per acre that has risen astronomically to the point where we have too many straws in the landscape, all of which are drawing water out of the water table so that the streams dry up much faster and much more completely than they ever did before we had fire suppression. And it's also, in particular, Douglas fir, which would have been really decimated by fire under the historical prehistorical fire regime before we got here, that is a fire-intolerant species, and whereas the oaks are not. And oaks have been displaced by Douglas fir for that reason. So we'd wind up with a much less dense forest and one with a lot less Douglas fir and many more fish.
And more food for all of the critters.
Yeah, including us.
Well, sir, one of the things we wanted to do tonight was just, kind of put the word out that we are entering what we're calling prescribed burn season. This is looking like it's happening. These bird windows are opening up. So you are likely to start seeing some smoke out there. And there are projects planned. I know in the southern Humboldt region down to Usaw Forest, we're looking at projects, in the lower Mattole. We're looking at projects in the Edersburg area, Bryceland area. You saw Redwood Forest and at the community park. We just ask, please have some understanding, with the effects. We know that smoke is always unpleasant, no matter when it is. It's always something we have to work with. But consider that the minimal smoke in a controlled fashion at the right time could be a lot better than catastrophic fire conditions later. That's basically the trade-off we're looking at. We encourage you out there, if you have feelings about this, if you're unsure about it, to look into learning about it and trying to understand why people are trying to do it. Definitely, like we said, the Prescribed Burn Association is a great place to start. Just know that you're also invited to participate. So these are kind of some of the points I want to say specifically too, that just to kind of cap off with a story that ties this all together is myself as the chief of Telegraph Ridge. That's the fire department out in Edersburg area. We actually worked on a capacity building grant couple years ago now through the Edersburg Fire Safe Council. And part of that capacity building grant was to build two shovel-ready projects. And so the first shovel-ready project that we identified through our community meeting and through our department, the fire department, was to try to create some defensible space assistance. And so we helped with the development of that grant project, the application with Sibel Emmett and Julia Cavalli with Natural Resources Planning and the County Coordination Team, and in partnership with Bryceland Fire. And we submitted that application to the California Fire Safe Council all together and got that project. And now we're seeing the fruits of that. The second shovel-ready project we went for was designing a prescribed fire around the Edersburg Fire Station. We're happy to say, so through that project, we built a burn plan, and we are looking to implement that hopefully within the next few weeks. This is something we're hoping, we're happy to do. We're doing it in partnership also with the French family and the French Ranch, which are our neighbors, very good neighbors to the fire department. And it's going to be between 15 and 20 acres, weather and circumstances defining at the moment. But it's going to our objectives are hazardous fuel reduction, strategic hazardous fuel reduction for the fire department and our community emergency response center, oak woodland restoration, grassland restoration, and fir encroachment abatement, plus training, which is in partnership with the Mattole Restoration Council, who got an awesome grant to help provide training stipends to firefighters who are doing the hardcore work on prescribed fire, so that we're not just asking everybody to come out for free all the time. Mm-hmm. And public outreach and education. So if you're interested, come out, join the PBA so you can help us do it too.
How do you access the PBA? Let's get a website.
Yeah, I think it's just Humboldt. Let's see. We should know that, huh?
PBA.
Yeah, is that it?
And don't feel like you can't, you have to know whether a fire is a prescribed burn or not before you call, because part of the requirements of conducting one of these is that you have to notify everybody.
You could also join your fire departments.
Well, everybody. Yeah.
Hey, can I make a quick analogy real quick before we go? You can kind of think of prescribed fire like small earthquakes, right? You know, nobody minds those little 4.2 earthquakes, but nobody wants to see an 8-pointer destroy their house. So, you know, I feel like that's a good analogy to kind of put it into perspective.
All right. Thanks, all of you, for joining us tonight for the Southern Humboldt Fire Safe Council. This has been Gray Shaw and Fire Radio.
This has been a KMUT podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.